China-based electric vehicle maker XPeng debuted its latest model today. The XPeng P5 family smart sedan joins a growing roster of smart vehicles by XPeng as it looks to stake out its position in China's red-hot EV market. Let's talk more about it with Brian Gu, XPeng Vice Chairman and President. Brian, always good to see you. Thanks for coming on here this morning. Take us through the vehicle. What makes it a smart sedan?
Well, this is a truly an innovation packed in a family sedan platform. First of all, it's very smart because it has one of the most capable autonomous driving systems on board. It will be world's first production level vehicle to incorporate LiDAR technology in a sensor package. It also will have equipped with our XPilot 3.5 software that allow it has, the NGP in the city driving scenario. NGP meaning navigation pilot, guided pilot. So that's also one of the most advanced in China at the moment compared to other small companies, small EV players. And then thirdly is that it will have a cabin design that really try to design cool smart features that really utilize its space to design interesting features for people to use inside the cabin. So those are features that I think have not been seen before in other products.
Yeah, you and Brian were talking during the break about the fact that the front seats fold down, there's a fridge in the back, a lot of cool things that one is not necessarily used to seeing in a car. What kind of demand are you expecting for this? I was looking at your numbers, your year-to-date deliveries of your vehicles, nearly 46,000. How much do you think this sedan is going to boost your numbers, and what kind of early demand indications are you getting?
Well, let me just give you a few sort of data points. So obviously, we are not here to provide any guidance. First of all, this product is squarely targeted at one of the largest segments of the Chinese sedan market. The price point is where I think the probably one of the most popular price segment for these foreign brands. So it will be compared to, for example, Toyota Camry, Honda Accord, Volkswagen sedans as well. So the price tag around 200,000 RMB is squarely at the largest family sedan segment. Secondly, is that upon the sort of announcement of this P5, we actually received early indications of pre-orders. The momentum of that is very strong. So what I can say is that compared to the similar launch of P7, our flagship product last year, it's multiple fold of increase, probably around three times fold of the pre-order indications that we received. So we have actually very strong hope that this will become a large volume booster for us. As we discussed in our quarterly earnings result a couple of weeks ago, we anticipate our fourth quarter, upon the launch, official delivery of this P5, will hit monthly delivery peak around 15,000 per month. That will be more than doubling of our August monthly delivery numbers.
Brian, also, you're getting a lot of social media attention this morning on your plans around flying cars. What are your plans around flying cars? We've talked a little bit about this in the past. When do you expect to start delivering them?
Well, I think the one of the things that XPeng is focused on is trying to really think about the ecosystem of transportation utilizing similar technologies in autonomous driving, sensor, motor, battery, et cetera. And flying car is actually one of the product that we are, developing with one of our associate companies that we invested in to come up with that product. This is a product that, designed to be a vehicle but has flying capabilities and will be sold through our own network through XPeng XPeng stores. But that is still under development, so we'll probably see this couple, 2 to 3 years away for a product to be commercially delivered.
And Brian, I wanted to broaden it out and ask about, I love talking about all the cool products, but I do have to ask about some recent commentary from a Chinese official about the electric vehicle market there. The Minister for Industry and Information Technology, talked about needing fewer electric vehicle companies in China, that they're small and scattered. Now, presumably he's not referring to a company like XPeng, which is not a particularly small company in the landscape there. But I do wonder, are you having discussions with the Chinese government? Are you planning on making acquisitions related to the comments that we heard? How should we be thinking about those comments in relation to XPeng?
Well, first of all, I think in the past 5 years or so, there are quite a number of EV companies, startup that has built up capacities, but without a successful product. So there's a lot of empty capacity needs to be consolidated. So I think that's one of the reasons I think the government is trying to rationalize and optimize the capacity utilization of all these plants. Clearly, we have been building our own plant. So we're in the middle of constructing our second and third plant in Guangzhou and Wuhan. So currently, we don't really have a capacity constraint. But I think in the long run, if there's more capacity need, I think government is encouraging the consolidation of utilizing existing capacity rather than building new ones. I think that's what the government's objective is. Currently, we don't really have that need, but obviously that will be one of the tools that we can use if we need much bigger capacity given our growth trajectory.
And Brian, just quickly, given the drop that we've seen generally in U.S.-listed Chinese companies, is there anything message you would want to deliver to investors to reassure them about the path for XPeng?
Well, I think there's not much I can say about capital markets because that's totally not something we can influence or control. But what I can say is that the sector that we are in is experiencing tremendous secular growth. And I think as a leader of that sector, or one of the, you know, sort of technology leader, I would say, not the volume leader at the moment, but I think we have every confidence that we'll be, generating more than industry growth for the foreseeable future. And I think that will be exciting segment for investors to get exposure to.
Brian Gu, XPeng Vice Chairman and President. Always nice to see you. Congrats on the launch. We'll talk to you soon.
Thank you very much.
Online luxury retailer Mytheresa reported 36% growth in its net sales for its fiscal fourth quarter, the company reporting relatively robust demand here, even as earnings per share trailed estimates by a bit. Let's dig into the numbers more with Michael Klieger. He is the CEO of Mytheresa. Thank you for being here, Michael. I wanted to ask you, first of all, just kind of a broad question about demand right now, where you're seeing demand, in what kind of product are you seeing the strongest demand, and in what geographies are you seeing the strongest demand?
Thanks for having me. On product, it's really the categories that, of course, suffered from the conditions last year. So we see great uptick in dresses, great uptick in heels and clutches. So really the trend to going out again, joining festivities, and then also vacation. People love to go back on vacation. And so we saw good upticks also on beachwear and sandals. Geographies, the U.S. is leading. We reported 133% growth in the fourth quarter in the U.S., by far the fastest growing sector geography for us.
Michael, we're hearing from a lot of retailers, they're having difficulty getting product to market because of all sorts of supply chain issues during the pandemic. Are you having difficulty getting product?
Luckily, no. We were impacted last year. We only sell luxury goods, luxury products. They are predominantly produced in Europe. So we saw an impact last year when production stopped in Italy in March, April, May. But for fall, winter, we are delivered as good as in 2019. So luckily, we seem to be insulated in our sector from the problems that we hear about.
And you all also are getting a little bit into beauty. You had a beauty pop-up collaboration with some of the Estee Lauder brands. What kind of demand were you seeing there? And is that going to be a growth category for you?
Yes, correct. I mean, we had a wonderful collaboration with Estee Lauder companies. We are, of course, looking at other luxury lifestyle categories to augment our offer to our top customers, and beauty is, not surprisingly, one of those categories. We are really interested in who is buying something like that. Does it end up in the same basket? Do we create new baskets? And that's where these initial pop-ups, and we will do more pop-ups in the next couple of months, really help us to understand what type of consumer demand are we facing here. And also, too, beauty is a big category. We believe skincare is highly attractive, but we would also like to understand, of course, fragrances and decorative cosmetics. So very happy with the first pilot, but we are still exploring.
Michael, are you having any difficulty getting customers or just keeping customers on the platform as they become more mobile? Certainly, it's a different shopping situation today compared to 1 year ago.
You're absolutely right. I mean, what we saw in the last 12 months has been really a change in consumer behavior. Luckily, many of those changes are actually in our favor. So the share of online and luxury has really accelerated. It is a sector that is still trailing some of the other consumer sectors. So we have now slightly south of 20% online share in luxury. We still believe we can grow to 30% by 25. The share of mobile is going up again. During the pandemic, the choice for devices was more desktop, but now it's back in mobile, which is also good for us because we really focus on the mobile devices for our business in terms of web design, in terms of our app. And then during the pandemic, of course, there was a bigger focus on loungewear, on tops, on sneakers, and now back in outerwear, back in evening wear, that tends to bring also higher baskets. So we saw in the fourth quarter a huge jump up in top customer spend on our website, which is driven by occasions. I mean, our top customers start spending when they have occasions to wear luxury goods.
We need some occasions, don't we? We have sorely been missing occasions. Just to piggyback on Brian's question, your growth in new customers was 110,000, which was a record for you. So what kind of retention are you seeing and what kind of investments are you making in retention of those customers?
No, very important questions. We saw over the last couple of quarters, huge jumps in new customers, which is good, but the complete answers only when you see what is the retention on these new customers, the repurchase rate, as we call them. So we always look at new customer cohorts within the first 90 days. What is the repurchase rate of those? And we are very lucky and proud to report that the repurchase rate of, for example, the Q2 new customer cohorts is now in Q4 better than the Q2 new customers that we acquired a year ago. So we not only acquire a record number of new customers, but the repurchase rate is stable, if not even slightly higher. What do we do to achieve that? One core focus is, of course, always capsules, always new products, products that you can only find with Mytheresa, a very high focus on excellence and service. We use the Net Promoter Score internally. Q4 saw another increase. So it's not only attracting customers, but convincing them with the offer, with the service, that this is the best platform for luxury. We predominantly refrain from promotions and discounting because we saw in the past that such customer cohorts that you attract with this method only stay on if you continuously offer discount. And we are very much focused on a full price business in line with the overall strategy in luxury.
Interesting. And we certainly have seen ability to hold price for many different categories now versus several years ago. Michael Klieger, Mytheresa CEO, good to catch up with you. Thanks for the time this morning.
The IPO train appears to be kicking back into high gear. This morning, sneaker maker On Holding debuted over at the New York Stock Exchange. Again, we're still waiting for that first trade for that company. Rava Allbirds is expected to IPO soon. The same for electric truck maker Rivian. John Tuttle is vice chairman at the New York Stock Exchange and joins us now. And John, I'm sure you're wearing the On sneakers this morning here. That company is about to debut over by you guys. What do you think is driving this pickup in IPO activity right now?
That's a good question. And I am wearing some On sneakers. I'm drinking some Dutch Bros coffee, who's also going public today. But it is an exciting time for the equity markets. I mean, 2020 was a record year for the New York Stock Exchange. We've already surpassed that record in 2021. And it's a group of companies from across geographies and sectors that are coming to market. What we're seeing right now in the market and what we expect through the end of the year and probably into 2022 is a lot of technology companies, a lot of healthcare companies, but also a lot of consumer-facing names like you see behind me with On sneakers and Dutch Bros coffee. So investors are attracted by what they're seeing in the marketplace. A lot of these companies have been performing well as we make our way through what I hope are those final stages of the pandemic, and the market's been giving them a very warm reception when they go public.
You know, what's also interesting, John, hey, it's Julie here, is that we have seen a shift in the way that they're going public, right? The first half of the year was all about SPACs. And then completing those mergers and going public. Now it seems like, at least anecdotally, that we're shifting more back towards traditional IPOs and also direct listings. What do you think is going on there? Is that what you're, I mean, I say it's anecdotal. You guys have the numbers. Is that what you're seeing, and why do you think we're seeing that?
Well, first of all, I'm excited that there are options for companies and how they go public. Now there are more pathways to go public that are more tailored to meet a company's objectives as they become a public company. So now companies can take different paths. So SPAC is obviously one of them that you mentioned, direct listings, IPOs, and we're seeing a healthy mix of all of them. Historically, and what we're continuing to see is that most companies will come to market via the traditional IPO route. But what we're also seeing is that more and more companies are going through the direct listing. So if you remember, we had one in 2018 with Spotify, one in 2019 with Slack. And since that time, the number of companies that have chosen that route has increased significantly and will continue to. So what I think is most exciting, and we've been leading a lot of this innovation here, is that companies have more options and investors have more options.
John, why do you think they are choosing direct listings?
Well, companies go public for different reasons. Historically, it had been to access capital that they could use to grow and expand their business, launch new products, and tap into new geographies. Companies don't necessarily need to raise capital at the time of their listings. It depends on every company's business model and fundamentals, but they may be looking for some of the other benefits of being a publicly traded company and prioritizing those when they come to the market. And that can be liquidity for their investors and shareholders, is what we oftentimes see with direct listings, having a share currency that they can use for M&A activity to grow and expand the business, or even just branding and visibility as they look to establish themselves as a great global, well-governed public company. So companies, in short, companies are going public for different reasons now.
And John, talk to us about momentum. Is it safe to say 2021 is going to surpass 2020 in terms, you know, that we're going to continue the momentum and it's going to be a record year? And then what happens in 2022, which is definitely going to be something of a transition year, it seems, for the economy?
Well, we expect a robust pipeline of companies for the back half this year. We're already setting all-time records at the New York Stock Exchange when it comes to new equity issuance or IPOs. And there's a whole host of reasons for that. Some companies are performing quite well and view this as the right time for them to come to market for the reasons we identified before, to raise capital, for liquidity, for M&A, or even just for branding as well. But also, as investors look at different asset classes and where to allocate their capital, one of the ones that has been giving them a meaningful return over the past few years and in the past 12 months in particular are equities and IPOs. So as long as those conditions continue, where interest rates are low and relatively stable, volatility is low and relatively stable, and companies' public comps, or the companies they're comparing themselves to in the public markets, are flirting with their record highs reflected by our indexes, the IPO window will remain open.
John, within that pipeline of IPOs, what component, or is there a percentage of Chinese companies in the mix? I mean, the regulatory outlook for China has continued to worsen this year. Have you just seen Chinese companies they're just frozen out? They're unlikely to go public anytime soon.
Yeah, it's a really good question. And we saw a lot of activity in the first half of the year with companies from China coming to the U.S. markets to access capital to grow their businesses, and investors were participating in that. Two factors have come into play. First is that Congress passed legislation that increases scrutiny on auditors of many of these Chinese companies and requires inspection. The second part of that is the SEC has indicated that they want to see increased disclosures around some of these companies that are going public in the United States and some of the structures that they may be using to access the public markets. So what's going to happen is it's going to require a diplomatic solution with regard to the audit inspection and some of these other components of it. We encourage our governments to get together and talk, and we hope that happens sooner rather than later.
And John, just to follow up on that, do you think what would happen to the overall market and what you guys do over there if Chinese companies are delisted?
And look, we hope Chinese companies are not delisted. But we also want to make sure that the U.S. capital markets continue to be the most well-governed, the broadest pool of liquidity, the deepest investor base of any marketplace in the world. If we look at our profile of companies here on the New York Stock Exchange, we have 2,400 companies. They're from 46 countries around the world. They represent over $40 trillion worth of market capitalization. So we're well represented across geographies, sectors, and sizes.
All right, we'll leave it there. John Tuttle, Vice Chairman over at the New York Stock Exchange. Enjoy those On sneakers. I heard they're very comfortable. Good luck for the rest of the week.
Thanks so much. Indeed, they are. Take care, guys.
With millions of images shared online every day, it's becoming increasingly difficult to determine their authenticity. California-based TruePix developed software that verifies images, what is real from the moment that image is captured. And now it's raised $26 million in a Series B funding with Microsoft's venture arm M12 leading the round. Let's bring in the CEO of TruePix, Jeffrey McGregor. We're also joined by Samir Kumar, who is M12's managing partner. Great to have both of you on. Jeff, let's start with you because we followed the progress of your company for several years now. It feels like there is some momentum in really getting support for image verification. You had Senators Portman and Peters recently establishing a deepfake task force at the Department of Homeland Security. Now you've got this funding round. What do you think has raised the awareness of the need for image verification?
Akiko, thanks for having us. I really appreciate it. I think that there's just a universal need for improved trust across business and society. And I think that as time has gone on, there's just been a secular trend of disinformation, fraud, deception, and it's really affected every area of the internet, including the services we use every day, including social media, including the political environment. And being able to restore trust in the visual media that we look at as consumers every day can have a profoundly positive impact on the internet and society.
Samir, we've seen M12 really pick up the speed and size of your investments more recently. Why does TruePix make sense for Microsoft?
Yeah, we actually first got to meet Jeff and team almost 2 years ago. And I think in that time, as we've looked at the asymmetry between what is now possible with software tools to use AI to create synthetic content versus techniques and approaches to defend against the misuse of those approaches and to defend against fraud, misinformation, and deepfakes, there's a large asymmetry there. And I think what we really liked about what TruePix is doing, which is taking this approach of authenticated capture of content, being able to have trust that the image that you're looking at was in fact captured in the conditions and on a device in certain, at a certain time. And that has held true as that media has propagated or been disseminated, whether it's on the web or in social media. I think we came to the conclusion that this has to be a critical part of the defense against misinformation. If we rely exclusively on forensic techniques to identify a fake or a deep fake, that's a losing battle. The fundamental AI approach that's been used to generate these fakes has built into it the ability to get better over time and learn from when we find new forensic techniques to capture these fakes, which will ultimately lead to better fakes. So you can't rely on forensic approaches to do this. You have to be able to say, we have to trust where this content came from. Was it captured in specific conditions that are still true as we look at the content today? And that's really what we liked about TruePix. And TruePix is also a founding member of the provenance-associated new industry standard, the C2PA, and being able to drive standards, interoperable standards in industry to make provenance and controlled capture something that becomes widely adopted.
Yeah, and Jeffrey, I mean, I guess it's nuanced there to kind of distinguish between proving an image is false versus proving it true. But, you guys have seen some pretty impressive growth from clients that maybe no one really expected to be interested in this, particularly when it comes to proving the authenticity of photographs. Mainly, I'm looking at Ford Motor Company and Equifax. Talk to me about maybe the enterprise value in something like this, too.
Yeah, the enterprise value is all about automation and improved downstream decision making. So if you have photos and videos that are coming into your ecosystem, for example, you may be an insurance company that's taking in photos and trying to make a decision around processing an insurance claim, knowing that those photos and videos are authentic, real representations of what has happened with an authenticated time, date, and location allows you to have confidence in the decision around paying a claim in this example, right? And having that ability to make better business decisions is really the core value proposition of TruePix technology. And one thing I want to point out, Samir mentioned deepfakes. We've seen a lot of this in the political and societal sphere, particularly as it relates to social media and the content that can spread very rapidly. These same tools are being used to defraud businesses. So synthetic media can be created to generate fake headshots or damage on a vehicle. And enterprise is really left in a difficult position right now because they don't have tools that can help them determine authenticity until TruePix. So we're really excited to continue to drive this technology to market.
Jeff, you know, I mentioned that task force that's now been created at the Department of Homeland Security. You've got the technology in place to verify these images, but what do you think the government role is in trying to tackle disinformation, misinformation, fraud?
Akiko, you may have seen the Wall Street Journal reported today at Facebook's own study showed that one out of three teenage girls feel worse about their body after using Instagram. And Facebook, after doing that study themselves, has not made changes to the platform. So I think government's role is really legislating around this and ensuring that platforms put the right tools in place to ensure a better, healthier online ecosystem.
Samir, finally, I'm just curious to hear more about the progress you've made within M12, a record 55 investments last year. You're already on pace to break that number this year. What's the thesis that you've led with in terms of the investments, the technology you're looking for to get the Microsoft backing?
Thanks, Akiko. Yeah, we're very excited. I mean, for a fund that was founded in 2016, and where we are today in terms of the number of investments, you know, assets under management, and the growth in valuations for the companies that we've invested in, we're very excited about that progress. I think our core thesis is we are a financially driven fund. So we think about financial return first and foremost, but then we think about investing in companies where we really believe Microsoft can help and add value. And that means being able to grow value in the company by either providing access to Microsoft's customers, making Microsoft a customer, helping with go-to-market, helping with sales. And so you can imagine when we think about Microsoft's core business, it's in the enterprise. And we think about cloud, applied AI, business applications, cybersecurity, certainly new and emerging trends in deep tech or frontier tech. But the core thread across all of these is, can we help? Can we help these portfolio companies realize more value as a result of partnering with Microsoft? And then ultimately, does Microsoft then also benefit from learning what are the workloads, what are the use cases these companies are building, and what does that mean for the enabling infrastructure and technologies that Microsoft offers on things like Azure, so that Azure then becomes, let's say, the preferred cloud for these companies.
Samir Kumar, M12 Managing Partner, as well as TruePix CEO, Jeff McGregor. Good to have both of you on today. Really appreciate the time.
I want to turn to a company that is giving Wall Street a pretty big caffeine jolt today in its market debut. We've got shares of the Oregon-based coffee chain Dutch Bros up a whopping 60%, 6-0, in their first day of trading on the New York Stock Exchange. Now, the stock was initially priced at $23 a share, and that was at the high end of expectations, by the way. Joining me now is Joth Ritchie, president and CEO of Dutch Bros. And we're also joined by Yahoo Finance's Brooke DePalma. Thanks so much, guys, for joining us. So first off, congratulations, Joth. You started at humble beginnings. This company started out selling coffee from a push cart in a small town in Oregon to going public on the largest exchange in the world. Just tell us what that journey has been like and what today means to you and the company.
Well, what an amazing day, right? I mean, just the culmination of 30 years of hard work by thousands and thousands of employees and people across the western half of the U.S. that have really built Dutch Bros and really put all of us in this spot that we're at today to get the response that we got, to be able to tell a great story. And it's not just our employees, but also our customers that have been with us all the way through the years.
And right now, Dutch Bros is in 11 states. I'm on the East Coast, and I'm just waiting for it to come here. So with this extra capital in hand, do you intend to make your way to the East Coast?
You know, we'll continue to grow. We've been a very disciplined growth company from the beginning, and I think the disciplined strategy we put in place for growth, I see us somewhere on the Eastern Seaboard in the next maybe 3-4 years, and we'll see how far north that gets.
Joth, I know I was looking at some of your numbers, pretty impressive. Sales up 27% last year to over $325 million, but profits are thin, just about $5.7 million. I guess that's a reflection of just how much you're pouring back into the business. But what kind of insight can you give us on that profit number?
Well, a lot of just cleanup overall related to some debt and there was some employee compensation in there as well, but really, that's really more looking to the past than we are really looking to the future on where profitability is headed for the long term.
And Joth, right now there are about 471 shops across the U.S. A majority of those are franchise-owned. Now, we've seen staff shortages hit as well as wages hit all fast food chains across the U.S. How are you strategically working with your franchise owners to make sure that it doesn't hit hard?
So really, our franchisees have been an important part of our business from day one. Over the last 3 years, we've really accelerated our company-owned shops. So we're almost at about 45% company-owned now and 55% franchised. And most of our new locations in the future are going to be company-owned. You know, we certainly aren't immune to some of the market challenges related to hiring. However, I think we've gone from what I tell people, kind of a great situation in hiring to good. I think a Dutch Bros position in any market is a badge of honor for somebody in the part-time labor pool and really probably the best job you can have in a market. So we've done really well on that end. We haven't had the challenges that we've seen other people have. And as long as we keep our culture right, we focus on our people, we focus on the chemistry that we have within our stands and delivering that service, you know, we feel like we're in a pretty good place on the labor end.
So, Joth, I know you have a pretty devoted fan base. Your loyal customers refer to themselves as Dutch Mafia. How do you plan to build on that momentum and take on the established chains, you know, as you move across the country, chains like Starbucks, like Tim Hortons and Dunkin'?
Yeah, a couple ways. I mean, one is remember, I mean, we're 30 years old and really have been in with Starbucks all along the way. I mean, two Pacific Northwest brands. Really growing, and I think in most markets that we're in, we're probably a half a mile to a mile away from any trading area that's been developed by Starbucks. As we continue to grow, I think one is that our rewards app, we've had over 2.7 million people sign up for our app since February 1st, and I think that's a really good indication of as we've gone into new markets and have people sign up and be part of the loyalty that is Dutch Bros, they get to experience the brand and some of the ways that we reward them for their continued support. Two is that we have to continue with our service model. I think the big difference for Dutch Bros is that we're a beverage company, but we're really built on the backs of our people and the service that we provide every day in our stand. So we maintain our culture, we maintain our service, we maintain the great people program that we have, our people systems. I think we're gonna do really well. And that's been the case for this company for 30 years, and we believe it's the case that we'll take forward for the next 30.
And one aspect that's also unique to Dutch Bros is that Blue Rebel energy drink. There's not many energy drinks at other major coffee chains across the U.S. You know, I know that those account for about 24% of your sales, actually more than the hot coffee and cold coffee individually. So how exactly do you see the energy market moving forward, that energy drink? Will it continue to be a big piece of your portfolio?
I believe so. I think energy's been a big part of our program for the last 15 plus years. And what Blue Rebel's done is it continues to grow at double digits every year. I think that energy market is a big market when you think about, you know, what happens in convenience stores and grocery stores and how broad the Red Bull and Monster and the category that those companies have created and the brands that have been created. I think there continues to be a great opportunity for us in energy. We also serve it the way you want it. So you can flavor your energy, you can put it in a slushy type drink, you can put it in an ice drink, or you can just drink it straight up. And I think what's fun is the customization of what we do with energy is, I think, really a unique proposition for us.
I'm anxious to try it, Joth. You got to make your way over to the East Coast. I want to just ask you about... Sounds good. Well, we're happy to try it. Want to ask you, though, about the unusual stock structure with this IPO, because I know that your co-founder and chairman, Travis Boersma, I hope I'm saying his name right, Travis Boersma.
You said it great. Yep.
Great. He controls 74% of the voting shares, and that gives his shares a much larger voice than, I guess, common shareholders. Why did you guys decide to structure it that way?
Well, I think Trav and the family and the Boersma family have been such an important part of the growth and what this company is all about. I mean, it's been built on their backs, and we really felt like it was a great indicator. If I'm a shareholder and I know that Trav has control and you know what this company's been built on and what's important to this business, I feel really good about Trav having that level of voting ability, and know that having him and his discipline and his feeling about people and culture and community and what he does for people, I like our chances with him in the position that he's in.
And Joth, I do want to note very quickly, Dutch Bros is also very mission-oriented, very focused through Dutch Love Day in February. As you make this public debut on a larger landscape, how do you hope that mission moves forward?
Well, I hope we can continue to share our philanthropic efforts as we've done for 30 years, continue to grow that and expand that. I think that Dutch Love, our Drink One for Dane, which supports ALS, and then we just did our Buck for Kids program on Friday of last week to support local children's programs in every market that we're in. One of the pieces we're after is to make a difference in our community and for our customers, and we think the philanthropy that we have is one of the cornerstones of what we're about.
I'm taking a look at the stock here, and it just keeps going up, Joth. I mean, now it is up 66, almost 67% here. And it's Wall Street debut. I mean, I know hindsight's 2020, but do you think, I don't know, maybe we could have priced this thing a little bit higher?
Oh, I think you can always say that. I think everybody who's lucky enough to be in this position can say that. But I think, honestly, we're lucky and just privileged to be in the position that we're in and just super excited and going to enjoy the day. I mean, we know people have high expectations on what we're going to do, and maybe this is an indicator of the excitement around the brand. And we're excited to deliver that for people.
Well, you're certainly off to a pretty good start. Joth Ricci, your president and CEO of Dutch Bros, and of course, our own Brooke DePalma. Thanks so much for being with us.
All right, we have got a little more than 45 minutes to the closing bell, but we want to talk about $281 million and how Penny Pritzker, the former U.S. Secretary of Commerce and a founder of Inspired Capital, along with another Inspired Capital founder, Alexa von Tobel, intend to deploy that money. And we welcome them both to the platform right now. Congratulations on raising that money. And this is the second fund that you've launched. I'm on your webpage now looking at how you deployed the first round of funding. So, Secretary Pritzker, let me start with you. When you look at the diverse different kinds of companies from the first round, you know, Finix, I think it's pronounced, helping manage and monetize payments for business. Then you've got a data-driven real estate company. And then you've got a company that is helping support women leaders. How do you choose from everyone out there to start funding?
Our fund, Inspired Capital, is really a generalist fund, and we're really focused on finding the best founders with the best ideas, whether it's in B2B and consumer fintech, or it's in healthcare tech, or next gen work, if you will. And Inspired, in our first fund, has had really a terrific group of founders that we're working with that we think are building really enduring companies that are bringing real value both to the consumer and to our business customers. So that's really what we're focused on at Inspired Capital.
And Alexa, going forward, building off of that success from your first fund, when you take a look at the second fund, I guess, is your strategy changing at all, or are you still taking a very similar approach?
What was great about this fundraise was it went very, very quickly because it was the same team with the exact same strategy. So to steal from Penny, she always says, we're staying very true to our knitting, which is really honing this craftsmanship of helping founders build businesses early. So seed Series A, investing across the country in founders of all types, all shapes and sizes, and really looking across all categories. And I think what we really care about being known for is just being excellent at helping founders really build businesses in a sea of endless capital. That is what we are excellent at.
Alexa, how do you all come together? Do you find the founders or do the founders find you?
It's a great question in so many different ways. I would say, you know, each week, probably about 100 companies come towards us, but it's actually the companies that we go and seek out where we have theses on categories. We've gone very, very deep, again, in categories like fintech and digital health, where we've spent most of our careers there. Those are places where we actually go seek out very specific parts of the stack that we're excited about and go tap founders on shoulders. And then lastly, we'll even incubate from time to time. So when the stars really align and we have the right team, people that we typically have known, will go as early as first money in. And in Fund One, we have a great company called Aurum that we helped stand up.
You know, and
that's
one
interesting
of the things
because,
that...
Yeah, go ahead.
No, I was just going to say, you know, one of the things you have to think about is our team at Inspired really has really deep operational roots. I mean, we've started among all of us at 10 different companies. And so, you know, one of the reasons that I think founders are attracted to us is because they know we've been through what they're going through. And, you know, in a time when the world is awash in capital, and founders are seeking investors who can bring value, not just a high valuation, but also can bring value to them and to their teams.
Hey, Secretary, that is a great point. And then another thing that also differentiates your fund from others out there is that you guys are female founded, you're female led. What type of advantage do you think this gives you? And I guess, why do you think some of these founders who are incredibly talented, who probably have interest from a number of funds, why they're finding you as the best option?
Well, I think it starts with, first of all, our understanding of the importance of diversity. And I think a lot of our founders believe that they want to have a variety of people at the table. You know, most companies are not founded with just one source of capital. And so they look at us and say, wow, these, you know, the Inspired folks bring operational excellence. They've been in the seat that I've been in. They're women, and half the population is women that they're trying to bring their products to market to. So I think they look and say, you know, look, we do business with everybody. We're not just doing business with women, and our team is not just women. But they look at us and they say, you know what, I can count on Inspired Capital for making sure that I'm going to get excellent advice with a diverse point of view.
I wanted to ask you, Alexa, I thought you were going to jump in there because you looked like you wanted to follow up. But for those of us who, it's exciting to watch what VC does with businesses that get started. But it's a different model, VC versus private equity. And yet, VC does take, I don't want to say a management role, but a supportive role. How do you allow the founder, Alexa, to maintain some of their independence, but draw upon the resources that you bring to the table?
I think that's a wonderful question. So first, I'll say we literally pick founders that we ourselves would go and work for. So I think that's a really important point, which is they are that special, they are that talented. And then we are there to, we always say, get in the boat with them and bring variety of resources to them, from introductions, strategic support, helping them build teams. You know, in the New York tech ecosystem where we're headquartered, we've employed, you know, close to 1,500 people here alone ourselves. And so just trying to help bring those advantages. And what's amazing is for each founder, we say, we're going to operate the way you want us to. We can be here. We're on text threads, Slack threads, nonstop for anything they need night and day, quite literally. But then sometimes we're there to like get really in it with them on an offsite in a big strategic, you know, a moment. So in whatever ways the founders want, often they are so talented that they know exactly where they want to go. And we are really there to give them extra wings. And I'm just so grateful for all the things that we get to bring to our companies. Obviously, with having somebody like Penny as a, you know, founding partner of Inspired, we can do so many things. And somebody like Penny has seen so many things that we do give our founders unfair advantages.
Secretary, one of the things that has changed since you did start, since you did launch your first fund, is we've gone through COVID and we've seen how so many businesses have been transformed as a result. So many founders have been forced to pivot and change their strategy in order to adapt to this quote unquote new normal. But I'm curious, has it changed, I guess, how you approach any of these businesses or how you're identifying attractive investments?
Well, look, the digitization of our economy has only been accelerated. So absolutely, it means we have to be accelerated. We have to move faster. We have to be, on our toes and move at the same speed that they're being forced to move at. And the other thing, what we've seen is exactly those companies that have adopted digital solutions, not just the companies we're backing, but their customers, those that have adopted digital solutions faster, performed much better during the height of COVID than the average company. So what it's taught us is things are speeding up and moving more quickly. Adoption's happening faster. And we need to be more attuned to what's the next stage of what is a company, what do the customers need? And that's where we get new ideas about new products or new incubations.
Secretary, we keep talking about your role as the Secretary of Commerce, but the two of you are accomplished business people. And I wanted to ask you first, Secretary Pritzker, if you could advise the current Congress or administration, because the tax proposals that have been put on the table might impact firms like the one you both are involved in now. Could they kill the golden goose with these tax proposals? Secretary Pritzker first.
Well, look, I think, first of all, you've got a lot of things going on right now in terms of the budget bill, the infrastructure bill. The part that nobody's talking about is the U.S. Innovation and Competition Act, which I think is extremely important. That's an act that will support R&D, that will also support early stage technologies and semiconductor development. And so, I think the tax bill, the fact that that the president's been really clear, he's not going to touch anyone, making under $400,000 a year. I think that's right and smart. But right now we're in the middle of the sausage making. So it's unclear. We don't see the marketplace being affected right now.
Alexa, did you want to weigh in on this or do you want to take a pass?
No, I was going to say, I think Penny said it perfectly.
Then let me follow up with you on this. As we look at the companies that you're going to be targeting, can you share with us anybody that's caught your interest without, Alexa, without divulging, because we don't want your competitors to jump in, but the kinds of things, even though it'll be similar to fintech that you've already had, but that is disrupting what we all know?
Absolutely. I mean, there's a number of categories that we are pretty excited about, and whether or not we make an investment is really about finding the right team with the right strategy. But I would just start by saying things like fintech in Latin America, we think is really interesting. The future of NFTs and how that's going to hit the consumer and what that's going to do to the wallet, we think is really interesting. In general, fintech on the continent of Africa is getting incredibly interesting. So we've gone very, very deep on thinking through a few categories there. The future of labor markets, obviously this is a category near and dear to both Penny and I's hearts, but we're watching automation take 10 million jobs out of the market over the next decade. So what is that going to mean for everyday workers? And then finally, just the tsunami of the creator economy and the independent worker economy and what that's going to mean for the wallet is another place where we've gone very, very deep. So just giving you a flavor of how mm-hmm. we like to work. We like to put together white papers that are anywhere from 5 to 25 pages long, where we really think deeply about a category and then go find the right team.
All right. I hope you will both consider coming back, because one of the things you just said, Alexa, that really caught my eye was looking south of the United States for potential growth. And I think, having relatives, this is an area that often gets ignored and there is so much potential. Unfortunately, we have to say thank you for joining us to talk about Inspired Capital. Both founders, Penny Pritzker, the former U.S. Secretary of Commerce, and Alexa Von Tobel, all the best to you both.